welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. This week, the Book Report launches a literary investigation into what I'm calling repeat offenders. We put the spotlight on new titles from top U.S., Canadian, and Scandinavian thriller writers, including a new addition to Stieg Larsson's epic series that began with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Can the author chosen to continue the storyline live up to our expectations? We're eager to find out. And I'm thrilled to welcome C.J. Box back to the program. His new book plucks a supporting character from an earlier title and pits her against one of the most evil villains we've seen in years. Is she up to the task? No time like the present to start our examination. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Mary Higgins Clark, the queen of suspense, just keeps them coming. The Melody Lingers On, her newest, tracks a disgraced billionaire, missing billions, and those determined to learn the truth at any cost. Lane Harmon works as the assistant to a famous interior designer. The job takes her to some of the most opulent homes around the tri-state area. When she's called to redecorate a modest townhome in Bergen County, she knows this job is most unusual. Then she learns the home belongs to the wife of a disgraced financier. Parker Bennett has been missing for 2 years. He dropped out of sight just before $5 billion in a fund he'd been managing vanished. Bennett was last seen on his sailboat in the Caribbean. Was it suicide, or did he stage his disappearance? Lane is surprised to find herself moved by Mrs. Bennett's sincere belief in her husband's innocence. Lane also finds herself being drawn to Eric, the Bennett son, who is determined to prove his father is not guilty. The closer Lane gets to the Bennetts, the more she puts her own life in jeopardy. Jan Maxwell performs the book.
Ranger Cole sat at the bedside of his wife Judy, holding her hand as she lay motionless. Her eyes closed, oxygen tubes in her nostrils. He knew that the second stroke would take her soon. Much too soon. Judy was 66 years old. They were only 6 months apart in age. She was older, and he always joked that he had married an older woman for her money. They'd been married 46 years. Kids of 20, so in love that when they went to Florida on a bus for their week-long honeymoon, it had felt like a limousine. They'd held hands all the way down. Neither one of them had gone to college. She worked as a sales clerk in Macy's, and he had a job in construction.
Her mother didn't want her to marry me, he thought. In school, I'd always been in trouble for having fights with other kids. Too quick to turn my hands into fists, a nasty temper. Her mother was right, but Judy calmed me down. I never was mad at her, not for one single minute. If I started yelling, like about a driver who cut me off, she would order me to stop it, tell me I was acting like a child.
To both of their regret, they never had been blessed with kids. Ranger reached over and with a gentle stroke ran his calloused fingertips across his wife's forehead.
You were always smarter than me, he thought. You were the one who told me I'd be better off getting a job with the city, that jobs in construction came and went. You were the reason I got to be a repairman on the Long Island Railroad. I worked from one end of the island to the other. You said it fitted my nickname. My father started calling me Ranger when I was a kid because I was always out of range of where I was supposed to be.
Judy had always told him how handsome he was.
That's a joke, he thought.
He was a short, bulky guy with big ears and bushy eyebrows, even though he tried to keep them trimmed.
Judy. Judy, Judy.
Anger welled up in the depths of Ranger's being as he thought about why Judy had had the first stroke 2 years ago, after they learned that the money they had invested in the Bennett Fund had disappeared. $215,000 that they were going to use to buy a condo in Florida. Money they had saved so carefully over the years. The condo they had seen was a real buy. An old lady who owned it had died, and her family wanted to get rid of it furnished. Judy had loved the way it was decorated.
Much nicer than I would have figured out how to do it, she said.
We'll give away everything here in the apartment. It's not worth the expense of getting a U-Haul. Oh, Ranger, I'm so ready to give up my job and get down to Florida and be in the sun. What's nice is with no mortgage to pay and having both our pensions and Social Security, if we're careful, we won't have to worry about money. And at just that time, the money in the Bennett Fund had disappeared, and that was the end of buying the condo. A few weeks later, Judy had the first stroke, and he had watched her exhausting herself, trying to keep up with the exercises to try to strengthen her left arm and leg. She tried to keep him from hearing her crying at night, but of course he heard her. It was Parker Bennett's fault that their lives had been destroyed. A lot of people didn't believe that he'd committed suicide by taking a dive off that fancy sailboat of his. Ranger didn't believe that that jerk had jumped in the water. In one of the newspapers after Bennett disappeared, Ranger had seen his picture. He was sitting behind an antique rich guy desk in his office.
Bennett's way of offing himself would be to sit behind that desk, all dressed up like he is in that picture, and get drunk on some single malt scotch, then shoot himself, Ranger thought. Our money helped pay for that fancy office.
And Judy had been so depressed and so sick that she had given up. He knew that was why she'd had the second stroke yesterday. He knew she was dying.
Don't die, Judy. Please don't die.
The heart monitor beside the bed began to go off. It was a loud, shrieking sound. In just a few seconds, doctors and nurses were rushing into the room. One of them began pounding on Judy's chest. Ranger could see that the blip on the screen that had been showing the heartbeats was no longer there. Now it was moving in a straight line.
That was The Melody Lingers On by Mary Higgins Clark. C.J. Box is the best-selling author of 18 novels, including the incredibly popular Joe Pickett series. His novel Blue Heaven won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Novel. CJ has also won the Anthony Award, the Gumshoe Award, and many others. CJ is a Wyoming native and has worked as a ranch hand, surveyor, fishing guide, small-town newspaper reporter, and editor. An avid outdoorsman, CJ has hunted, fished, hiked, ridden, and skied through Wyoming and the Mountain West. He and his wife have three daughters. Today, CJ returns to the program to speak about his newest standalone thriller, Badlands. CJ, welcome back to the Book Report.
Well, thank you for having me back. This is always fun.
So in Badlands, you've crossed the line into North Dakota. How come?
That's true, yes. Because, I'm best known for the Joe Pickett series, the Wyoming Game Warden. There's 15 books in that. But every once in a while, about every other year, I do a standalone book outside of the series. And it's usually based, like this one, on something that is happening, something that's really captured my attention that really doesn't work for a Joe Pickett kind of story. And in this case, I'm from Wyoming, and if you've noticed over the last few years how many friends and relatives and others have been going to North Dakota, either moving there or working there, and that's because of the huge Bakken oil field that has just emerged from the prairie there. And I was fascinated with that because I'd been to western North Dakota many times, and it was, in my mind, it was still kind of very sleepy, kind of agricultural area, mainly, Norwegian and German farmers and little towns struggling to survive. And to imagine that area suddenly transformed into a boom town, an oil boom town, fascinated me. And I wanted to get in the middle of that. And I thought there would be pretty good fodder for a book. And December last, I went up there to Williston, which I've kind of transformed into Grimstad in the book. And Williston is kind of the beating heart of the oil boom. And this is a town that 10 years ago had less than 10,000 people and dropping, that now, as of last December, they estimated the population of about 80 to 100,000, mainly men, in the Bakken oil field. And it was incredible the amount of oil that they were finding. And the atmosphere was just a new Wild West. It was about 30 to 1 men to women. The men were paid extremely well. A lot of them were living in temporary housing called man camps or lodges out on the prairie, and 101-mile-long trains of oil a day were going out of Williston to every part of the United States. So it was just incredible to me to see a transformation like that in such a short period of time.
You wrote that the North Dakota fracking fields and the developments are now visible from space. Is that true?
That is true. In fact, anybody who wants to see what I'm talking about can get on the internet. And NPR a couple of years ago had a story on the discoveries. And it's at night, you can't tell the difference in the light between Williston, North Dakota, Chicago, and Minneapolis because of all the oil flares, gas flares out on the prairie. It's huge.
You also wrote that Prairie, North Dakota now has rentals that exceed Manhattan. Is that true?
That is true. It's easing up somewhat. They're starting to build enough housing there that the crunch is not as bad as it was. But at the time I was there, people were renting out their houses for, you know, $3,000 to $4,000 a month per bedroom. The guys were paying for it. It was such an economic boom that anecdotally the McDonald's there was paying $18 an hour plus salary or plus benefits and housing just to keep the place open 24 hours a day to feed everybody.
That's a lot of Big Macs. But
yes, it is.
Okay, so regardless of your opinion about fracking, it seems to me its impact on crime, drug abuse, social upheaval, prostitution, strain on infrastructure is devastating.
Well, it's sort of proportional. Is the way the sheriff there who took me around put it. There was always a little percentage of that, just like there is in every community. But when the population swells that fast, and when you add in all the elements of, you know, young single men making, you know, $100,000 a year when they were making none previously without a lot to do, then, yeah, there's the crime elements and there are going to be people who prey in on them. And when I was there, what was happening in and around Williston, which I then fictionalized for the book, was a gang war between a motorcycle gang that ran most of the drugs in the area previously, being encroached upon by what's considered the most violent gang in America, MS-13. They were moving in and trying to take it all over. And there had been, at that point, 5 contract hits in an area that, again, like I said, less than 10 years ago, was just rolling farmland. So the juxtaposition of that kind of urban, sudden urban crime in an area where people are named Ole and Sven fascinated me.
We're speaking with C.J. Box on the Book Report. Well, introduce us to Cassie Duell.
Well, Cassie Duell is a 36-year-old single mom, widower. Her husband was killed in the Afghanistan war, and she was introduced in The Highway, which came out 2 years ago, which is by far the creepiest, scariest book I've ever written. But I really liked her character, and in this book, she's offered a job as chief investigator in Bakken County, North Dakota, and she takes the job because it doubles her salary, and she knows she'll be able to take care of her young son, Ben, and her mother, who's living with her. So we see this area in North Dakota through her eyes as she takes the job, moves from Montana to North Dakota, and she's immediately thrust into the middle of this gang war because the sheriff kind of surreptitiously asks her to investigate these killings as well as to find out if there's corruption within his own department.
You know, Cody Hoyt, who I loved, is remembered after a fashion in this novel. How did your loyal fans react to the end of The Highway?
Oh, some were quite upset with what happened in that book. Others, I got an awful lot of new readers because of that book. People who, you know, look at a 15-book series and get a little intimidated and thought they'd start with one that was different. So it's made quite an impact, but a lot of people miss Cody Hoyt, but Cassie Duell always kind of keeps him in mind when she gets into a struggle about what would he do and how would he handle it.
Right. You know, in the Badlands, the extreme cold of the North Dakota winter seemed like a vengeful character in the book. Did you actually go to North Dakota in the winter for research?
I did. I was there when I was doing the research for the book. I was there in December. And there were a couple days where it dipped down to about 30 below. And it's a different kind of cold than what I'm used to in the Mountain West. It's a lot more humid and a lot more bone chilling. And, it's a huge issue there because there's so many people working outside every day. One of the interesting facts I learned when I was there is that that particular county, Williams County in North Dakota, is number one per capita in the sales of Carhartt clothing and Corvettes. So that kind of gives you an idea of the impact.
Wow. Okay, Badlands, the audio edition, is narrated by January Lavoie. All of your Joe Pickett books are performed by David Chandler. Did you have a voice in selecting a woman to perform this novel, and was it because Cassie Duell is the main character?
Well, I did not have I didn't know who the narrator would be, but when I listened to the excerpts, when they sent them to me, I loved it. I thought it was perfect. I love her voice, and I love the fact that it's narrated by a female protagonist.
Right. You know, in preparing for this interview, I read you're a fan of Teddy Roosevelt, and I share your passion. What is it about Teddy that intrigues you?
Well, I think I've read just about everything I can about him over the years, and what in particular, the part of his life, even before he was president, fascinates me even more than when he was, because of the tragedies he went through and the way he handled it and the way he basically became Teddy Roosevelt in North Dakota when both his wife and his mother died on the same day. He went into a black depression and just went west to North Dakota and started a ranch. And here's this, New York blue blood out on a ranch with a bunch of cowhands, and it really did form his personality. And he later said, in fact, that he was a boy until he went to North Dakota and became a man. And because this all takes place in the same general area of where his ranch was in the Badlands of North Dakota, I was able to finally incorporate some of that into a book, which I love to do.
You know, I just have one word to say about the end of the book, and that is cliffhanger.
Oh, well, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So
yes, there's an open thread that continues throughout the entire book that will continue.
All right, so when can we expect Cassie back again?
Probably 2 years. Every other year is when the standalones come out, and I'm already kind of formulating the next plot.
Okay, and you're also going to come out with a new Joe Pickett novel?
Right. I'm working on that right now. Just about done with it. It should be out next March, and it's called Off the Grid. It's more of a Nate Romanowski novel, which means a very high body count.
And lots of mystery. Okay, CJ, I loved Badlands. It gets two thumbs way up. Thanks so much for stopping back in.
Well, thank you very much. I sure appreciate you having me back.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Badlands, performed by January Lavoie.
12-year-old Kyle Westergaard was halfway through his route, delivering the Grimstad Tribune, when he heard the high whine of car engines out on the highway in the dark. He eased his bike to a stop, never easy with the bulging canvas newspaper panniers hanging down on either side of the front wheel, and squinted south across the dark prairie. There were a lot of hot cars around town these days, and these particular cars were screaming. Kyle wanted to see them before they had to slow down to enter the town of Grimstad. He liked this view from the chalky bluff, and he looked forward to it every morning. It was the only thing on his route he looked forward to. His newspaper route was the worst one in town, and the farthest one from the Tribune dock. It was assigned to him because he was the newest carrier. His mom had said she'd drive him when he signed up for the job, and he handed over his signing bonus of $250. But after his first day on the job 2 weeks ago, she'd never been able to get up on time.
Instead, he paddled his bike to the Tribune and got in line behind the other carriers, most of whom were older and had cars. His route included all the new houses they were building on the south side of town, and the homes that got the newspaper were few and far between. Kyle spent a lot of time and effort riding his bike around mounds of dirt, fresh concrete curbs, and piles of lumber and building materials to locate the subscribers. Most of the people who lived in the new part of town were from somewhere else and couldn't care less about local news, so they didn't subscribe to the paper yet. At least, that's what Alf Peterson, the old gnome in charge of deliveries, told Kyle at the newspaper building. Although he had no trouble locating the houses for subscribers, he was good with street numbers and numbers in general. He was still having trouble keeping track of all the special requests. Some people wanted their paper placed inside the storm door. Some wanted it on their front porch, and one lady wanted it in her mailbox. He got confused over who wanted what, and he heard about it when the angry customers called Alf to complain about him. Too many had called, Alf said. Kyle's job was on thin ice. He paused and listened as the car engines got louder. He still couldn't see them. It was unusual to be able to hear them. On most days, there was an endless stream of heavy trucks on the highway to Watson City, and the usual traffic noise would have drowned out the sound and impeded the car race. It was another cold morning in the town of Grimstad in western North Dakota. Condensation billowed around his face, and his lungs stung from the cold. Frost clung to the metal frame of his bike, and the seat felt like a block of ice. His feet and hands were cold because he'd outgrown his boots over the summer, and he couldn't find his gloves that morning. Kyle liked to V his fingers and draw them to his mouth as if holding a cigarette, then exhale breath that looked like smoke. He did it now while he waited. It made him feel sophisticated. The prairie, as far as he could see, was punctuated by natural gas flares next to oil pumper units. The pumpers had heads like grasshoppers, and they bobbed up and down. The flares made what was once grassland look like a big city, although Kyle chose to think of those flames out there as Indian campfires. He liked that idea, that the prairie looked the same as it had when the Sioux and Cheyenne were around. Between where Kyle was on the bluff and the flares out on the prairie was the Missouri Breaks. The iced over river steamed in the cold. Kyle had a plan, and it involved that big river.
We've just heard Badlands by C.J. Box. Andrew Peterson resurrects his character, Nathan McBride, in Contract to Kill, book 5 in the popular series. When Toby Haynes witnesses a double murder, he begins to suspect his boss, Tanner Mason, as the perpetrator of the crime. Haynes calls in Nathan McBride, a CIA Special Ops veteran. McBride and his partner, Harvey Fontana, launch a covert investigation and discover that Mason, the security chief of one of the nation's leading private military contractors, is actually leading a top-secret operation to tackle crime plaguing the U.S.-Mexican border. Were the murders part of the strategy or part of a more diabolical agenda? McBride and Fontana find themselves engaged in a deadly game with stakes that reach around the globe. Dick Hill narrates.
Shindand District of Western Afghanistan, summer 2009. Tanner Mason tuned out the engine's drone and fought off a nagging fatigue. Outside the comfort of his vehicle, if he could call it that, a drab desert loomed under a twilight sky. Anything not beige was either brown or gray. Looking around the cramped interior, he wondered if the MRAP truly was mine-resistant and ambush-protected. So far, it hadn't been tested, which was just fine with him. He'd seen the hulks of other MRAPs in the scrapyard, and some of them looked pretty bad. Fortunately, his employers spared no expense when it came to protecting his people. Mason didn't know what one of these 25-ton babies cost, But the Marine Corps variant, the 6x6 Cougar, went out the door at $750,000. Mason's convoy held four vehicles, three of them belonging to Beaumont Specialists, Inc., plus one German unit for support. This was a private military contractor mission with Mason in command. Each MRAP held 10 men, consisting of two operators and eight combat personnel. Mason didn't like the term mercenary and never referred to himself or his men that way. They were private military contractors, PMCs. Technically, they were guns for hire. But didn't that describe all combat troops? Sitting across from him, Chip Hahn looked straight ahead with his usual neutral expression. A Korean-American, Chip was the same age as Mason, at 41. He'd rarely met a tougher individual than Chip, and he valued him as his second-in-command. Chip had once said that Mason looked like the blonde villain from Die Hard. Mason conceded a slight resemblance, at least from the neck up. The rest of Mason mirrored a professional cage fighter, because he'd once been one. Today's objective sat in the middle of a remote village sandwiched between two seasonal river basins. A local bigwig known as Mullah Sanjari had been positively identified as the man responsible for coordinating and conducting more than two dozen IED and RPG attacks against coalition forces. BSI's mission was twofold. First, kill or capture the Mullah. And second, recover or destroy any weapons or ordnance found inside his walled compound. Over the past 8 days, at varying times, Mason's convoy had driven in and out of the village without incident. Their MRAPs would roll in, drive around, and then leave. The strategy created a sense of normalcy, a ploy that had worked well in other locations. Today would be different. Mason made eye contact with Chip and mouthed, "You okay?" "Butterflies," Chip mouthed back. Mason nodded. "Me too." He pressed the transmit button and spoke calmly through his boom mic. 2 minutes. Final weapons and radio check. Everyone check in with squad leaders. After the sequence of radio calls ended, Mason told his troops, "No one hesitates. We shoot first and sort things out later. 60 seconds. Just inside the village, the convoy detoured east to avoid using the same route they had taken the day before. The ride got rougher as the convoy increased its speed. Mason received his 22nd call from the driver. "Everyone brace yourselves. We'll be braking hard. Turret gunners on my mark. 10 seconds. The M2 gunners were already in their slings, so all they had to do was straighten up. The roar of the engine stopped, and the rear doors flew open. "All squads, move out!" Warm air assaulted Mason's face as he started a mental stopwatch. As rehearsed, the Germans fanned out to position themselves at each cross street. 3 seconds. Mason yelled, "84s!" Half a dozen stun grenades flew over the compound's wall toward the buildings in the northeast corner.
That was Contract to Kill by Andrew Peterson. Many of us know Jack DeBrule as the co-author of several popular books with Clive Cussler. Today's book report spotlights DeBrule's own best-selling series. As The Lightning Stones begins, Philip Mercer sets out to visit his old friend and mentor, Abraham Jacobs. Jacobs has been working at the Lester Deep Copper Mine in Minnesota, leading a research team in a groundbreaking study into climate change and cosmic rays. But just as Mercer approaches the mine's bottom, he's stunned to hear automatic gunfire in the underground chambers. By the time Mercer finds him, his friend, and the entire research team have been executed. Mercer is left seeking answers and revenge. Scott Brick performs the book.
She shrugged into a shirt over a bra that hadn't yet dried from its earlier washing. It felt like clammy hands were cupping her barely there breasts. Dillman was leaning against the wall, asleep on his feet, and startled when she reopened her door. He suppressed another cough. "I know this place seems like a backwater, but they do have a doctor here," Amelia offered. "No," the disheveled man said. "I'll be fine." Earhart shook her head and then led him downstairs and through the Hotel Cecil's quiet lobby. Men were still drinking in the adjoining bar, but none saw the pair exit out into the moonlit night. The hotel was located on the waterfront of this sleepy coastal fishing village. Earhart started walking north, where an airstrip had been carved out of the jungle and Guinea Airlines had erected a hangar. It was late enough that all of the houses were dark. Water lapped turgidly on the nearby beach. "We have to go to my boat first," Dillman called, and preceded Amelia Earhart down to a lone jetty about 200 paces east of the hotel. Tied to the bamboo and teak dock was a 30-foot single-masted sloop with a darkened hull and off-white deck. It looked as dilapidated as the man who had sailed it here. The deck was covered in various stains, and the hull looked like it was home to every barnacle and woodworm in the South Seas. She had no idea where he had sailed from, but she wouldn't trust this tub to take her across the lagoon. "You're braver than you look, Mr. Dillman." He looked at her queerly, not getting the joke. "I need a hand with the chest." That's when Amelia noticed a tin steamer trunk resting on the deck next to the spindly ship's wheel. The case was battered and dented, and whatever color it had once been painted was chipped clear off. Parts of the trunk were blackened as though it had been rescued from a fire. It seemed fitting luggage for both sailboat and sailor. "Is that what Bert wants me to fly to Hawaii?"
"Yes. A representative from the Navy will meet you when you land and take possession of the trunk."
"I could fly it all the way to Oakland," she said.
"No. There will be too much publicity when you land there. Crowds can be controlled easier in Honolulu. Also, this needs to be put in safe keeping as soon as possible. It attracts lightning, Miss Earhart. I have it shielded as best I can, but you must avoid electrical storms."
"No problem there," she said, stepping aboard the sloop after Dillman. "I've been doing that since leaving the States in May. What's in the trunk?"
"Geological samples."
They both bent and lifted the case.
"Sheesh, fella. I kinda have a weight limit, you know." "This weighs 64 pounds, exactly."
He said this solemnly, because these 64 pounds had been his constant companion as well as hated burden for the better part of a month. And in all that time he'd fled from dark forces who wanted the contents of the trunk for themselves.
"Can you make allowances for it?"
His voice was pleading, and his eyes were even more haunted. At that moment she understood that the responsibility of transporting the trunk from wherever his journey had started was likely what had so wasted the man. When he had started out, Mike Dillman had probably been a robust individual and not the withered husk standing before her.
That was a sampling of The Lightning Stones by Jack DeBrule. The Nature of the Beast is book 11 in Louise Penny's incredibly popular Three Pines series. Hardly a day goes by when 9-year-old Laurent LePage doesn't cry wolf. From alien invasions to dinosaur sightings, the boy's tales are so extraordinary, no one believes him. Then the boy disappears, and the villagers, including Chief Inspector Armand Gabache, are faced with the possibility that one of Laurent's tall tales might have been true. A frantic search begins for the boy, setting off a sequence of events that leads to murder and betrayal. Robert Bathurst performs the book.
Their dinner guests had already arrived and were sipping drinks and eating apple and avocado salsa with corn chips by the time Armand returned. "Got Laurent home all right, I see," said Reine-Marie, greeting him at the door. "No alien invasions?" We nipped it in the bud.
Not quite, said Gabri, standing at the door to their study. One got through Earth's defences.
Armand and Reine-Marie looked into the small room off the living room, where an elderly, angular woman with ladders up her stockings and patches on her sweater sat in an armchair, reading. A strong smell of gin met them. A duck sat on the old woman's lap, and Henri, the Gamache's German shepherd, was curled at her feet, gazing up adoringly at the duck.
Don't worry about greeting me at the door, Armand said to Henri. It's fine, really.
He looked at the dog and shook his head. Love took all forms. This was, though, a step up from Henri's previous crush, which was the arm of the sofa.
The first hint of infestation was the smell of gin, said Gabri. Her race seems to run on it. What's for dinner?
Their neighbour, Ruth Zardo, demanded, struggling out of the armchair. How long have you been there? Reine-Marie asked.
What day is it? I thought you were out clubbing baby seals, said Gabri, taking Ruth's arm. That's next week. Don't you read my Facebook updates? Hag. Fag.
Ruth limped into the living room. Rosa the duck goose-stepped behind her, followed by Henri. I was once head of homicide for the Sûreté du Québec, said Gamache wistfully as they watched the parade.
I don't believe it, said Reine-Marie. Bonjour, Ruth, said Antoinette.
Ruth, who hadn't noticed there was anyone else in the room, looked at Antoinette and Brian, then over to Myrna.
What are they doing here?
We were invited, unlike you, you demented old drunk, said Myrna. How can you be a poet and never notice anything and anyone around you?
Have we met?
Ruth asked, then turned to Reine-Marie.
Where's Numbnuts? She asked.
He and Annie left for the city, along with Isabel and the kids, said Reine-Marie. She knew she should have chastised Ruth for calling their son-in-law Numbnuts, but the truth was, the old poet had called Jean-Guy that for so long, the Gamaches barely noticed any more. Even Jean-Guy answered to Numbnuts, but only from Ruth.
I saw the Lepage boy come flying out of the woods again, said Ruth. What was it this time? Zombies?
Actually, I believe he disturbed a nest of poets, said Armand, taking the bottle of red wine around and refilling glasses, before helping himself to some of the salsa with honey-lime dressing. Terrified him.
Poetry scares most people, said Ruth. I know mine does.
You scare them, Ruth, not your poems.
Oh, right, even better. So, what did the kid claim to see?
A giant gun with a monster on it. Ruth nodded, impressed.
Imagination isn't such a bad thing, she said. He reminds me of myself when I was that age. And look how I turned out.
It's not imagination, said Gabri. It's outright lying. I'm not sure the kid knows the difference anymore himself. He turned to Myrna. What do you think? You're the shrink.
I'm not a shrink, said Myrna. You're not kidding, said Ruth with a snort.
I'm a psychologist, said Myrna.
You're a librarian, said Ruth.
For the last time, it's not a library, said Myrna. It's a bookstore. Stop just taking the books.
Oh, never mind.
She waved at Ruth, who was smiling into her glass, and turned back to Gabri.
What were we talking about?
Laurent, is he crazy? Though I realize the bar for sanity is pretty low here. He watched as Ruth and Rosa muttered to each other. Hard to say, really. In my practice, I saw a lot of people whose grip on reality had slipped, but they were adults. The line between real and imagined is blurred for kids, but it gets clearer as we grow up.
For better or worse, said Reine-Marie.
Well, I saw the worse, said Myrna. My clients' delusions were often paranoid. They heard voices, they saw horrible things, did horrible things. Laurent seems a happy kid, well-adjusted even.
You can't be both happy and well-adjusted, said Ruth, laughing at the very thought.
I don't think he's well-adjusted, said Antoinette. Look, I'm all for imagination. The theatre's fueled by it. Depends on it. But I agree with Gabri. This is something else. Shouldn't he be growing out of it by now?
We've just heard The Nature of the Beast by Louise Penny. From Canada, we'll travel to Scandinavia for today's last two titles. Jussi Adler-Olsen returns with The Hanging Girl, the sixth book in his Department Q series. In the middle of his morning nap, Detective Carl Mork, head of Department Q, receives a call from a colleague on the Danish island of Bornholm. Carl is dismissive, as he has no desire to have a new case foisted on him. But that same day, he receives shocking news.
Now, Carl and his team have no choice but to lead Department Q into the tragic cold case of a vivacious 17-year-old girl who vanished from school, only to be found dead, hanging high up in a tree. The investigation leads to a strange sun-worshipping cult, where Carl and his team attempt to stop a string of new murders and a skilled manipulator who refuses to let anything or anyone get in the way. Graham Malcolm narrates.
Hey, Carl, wake up. The telephone is ringing again. Carl looked up sleepily at Assad, who was camouflaged like a yellow carnival. When he'd started in the morning, the overalls had been white and his curly hair black, so if there was even a splash of paint on the walls, it would be a miracle. "You interrupted me right in the middle of a complicated train of thought," said Carl, reluctantly taking his legs off the table. "Okay, sorry." The wrinkles of a smile appeared under the jungle of Assad's 9 o'clock stubble. What the heck was it, his happy round eyes expressed? A hint of irony, perhaps?
"Yeah, I know it was a late one for you yesterday, Carl," continued Assad. "But Rose goes nuts when you let the telephone ring all the time. So could you please just get it next time?"
Carl turned toward a glaring light from the basement window. A little cigarette smoke should put an end to that problem, he thought, reaching out for the pack and slamming his feet back up on the table as the telephone started ringing again. Assad pointed at it insistently and slid out of the door. It was turning into a hell of a situation with those two loud mouths jabbering at him incessantly.
"Carl," he said, yawning, with the receiver resting on the table.
"Hello," came from below. He took the receiver up to his mouth, with his arm languid. "Who am I talking with?"
"Is that Carl Merck?" said a voice in the lilting dialect of Bornholm. Definitely not one of the dialects that did it for Carl. It was like bad Swedish with some grammatical errors and no use anywhere except on the small island in the Baltic. "Yes, I'm Carl Merck. Isn't that what I just said?"
The sound of a sigh came from the other end. It almost sounded like relief.
"This is Christian Habasat. We met each other a lifetime ago, but you probably don't remember me."
Habasat, Carl thought, from Bornholm. Carl hesitated. "Yeah, I
served at the police station in Nexø when you and a superior were over here some years ago to escort a prisoner to Copenhagen."
Carl racked his brain. He remembered the prison escort well enough, but Habasat.
"Oh, right," he said, reaching over for the cigarettes. "Yes. Sorry for disturbing you, but maybe you've got time to hear me out. I've read that you've just solved a complicated case in the circus at Bellahøy.
My compliments, although it must feel frustrating when the culprit commits suicide before the trial." Carl shrugged. Rose had been frustrated about it, but Carl couldn't give a damn. It was just one less in the world to worry about.
"Okay, but you aren't calling because of that case, are you?"
He lit the cigarette and tilted his neck back. It was only 1:30, far too early to have used up his daily ration of cigarettes, which meant he should probably increase it.
"Yes and no. I'm calling about that case and everything else that you've so impressively solved in the last couple of years. As I said, I serve with the Bornholm Police and I'm currently sitting in Rønne, but I'm retiring tomorrow, thank God."
He tried to laugh. It sounded forced.
"Times have changed, so it's not very exciting to be me anymore. No doubt we all feel the same, but only 10 years ago I was the guy who knew everything about what was happening on most of the central and east coast districts of the island. Yeah, you could say that's why I'm calling."
Carl let his head fall. If this guy wanted to convince them to take on a case, he needed to nip this in the bud immediately. He certainly didn't want to get involved with anything connected to an island, where the specialty was smoked herring, and which was closer to Poland, Sweden, and Germany than Denmark.
"Are you calling because you want us to look into something for you? Because if that's the case, then I'm afraid I'll need to direct you to our colleagues on one of the floors above us. We've got far too much to do down here in Department Q."
It went quiet on the other end of the line, then the caller hung up. Carl stared in bewilderment at the receiver before slamming it down. If the guy was so touchy, then he damn well didn't deserve any better. Shaking his head, he'd hardly managed to close his eyes before the stupid thing rang again. Carl took a deep breath. Some people really needed it hammered home for them.
"Yes," he shouted into the receiver. Maybe that would scare the idiot into hanging up again.
Carl? Is that you?
It wasn't the voice he'd expected to hear. He frowned. "Mum, is that you?" he asked tentatively. "I get really frightened when you holler like that. Do you have a sore throat, sweetie?" Carl sighed. It had been more than 30 years since he'd left home. Since then, he'd dealt with violent criminals, pimps, arsonists, murderers, and rows of bodies in all manner of degrees of decomposition.
That was a sampling of The Hanging Girl by UC Adler Olson. The literary world was stunned and saddened by the death of Stieg Larsson more than 10 years ago. But fans of Lisbeth and her crusading journalist colleague have a new story to enjoy. Swedish journalist David Lagercrantz was hand-chosen by the Larsson estate to write The Girl in the Spider's Web. This up-to-the-moment political thriller resurrects the troubled genius hacker who thrilled the literary world in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. Book Report favorite Simon Vance performs the book.
Ove Levin, the newspaper guru from Cerner Media, was due to present a strategy session for Millennium magazine later that morning, and Blomqvist ought to be rested and ready for combat. But he had no desire to be sensible. Only reluctantly did he get up and make himself an unusually strong cappuccino with his Jura Impressa X7, a machine which had been delivered to his home a while ago with a note saying, "According to you, I don't know how to use it anyway." It now stood there in the kitchen like a memorial to a better time. He no longer had any contact with the person who had sent it, nor did he feel that his work was particularly stimulating these days. Over the weekend, he had even considered looking around for something new, and that was a pretty drastic idea for a man like Mikael Blomqvist. Millennium had been his passion and his life, and many of his life's best, most dramatic events had occurred in connection with the magazine. But nothing lasts forever, perhaps not even a love for Millennium. Besides, this was not a good time to own a magazine dedicated to investigative journalism. All publications with ambitions for greatness were bleeding to death, and he could not help but reflect that while his own vision for Millennium may have been beautiful and true on some higher plane, it would not necessarily help the magazine survive. He went into the living room, sipping his coffee, and looked out at the waters of Riddarfjärden. There was quite a storm blowing out there. From an Indian summer which had kept the city's outdoor restaurants and cafes open well into October, the weather had turned nightmarish, with gusts of wind and cloudbursts, and people hurried bent double through the streets. Blomqvist had stayed in all weekend, not only because of the weather. He had been planning revenge on an ambitious scale. But the scheme had come to nothing, and that was not like him, neither the former nor the latter. He was not an underdog, and unlike so many other big media figures in Sweden, he did not suffer from an inflated ego which needed constant boosting and soothing. On the other hand, he had been through a few tough years. Barely a month ago, the financial journalist William Borey had written a piece in Cerner's Business Life magazine under the heading, "Mikael Blomqvist's Days Are Over." The fact that the article had been written in the first place and been given such prominence was of course a sign that Blomqvist's position was still strong. No one would say that the column was well written or original, and it should have been easy to dismiss as yet another attack from a jealous colleague. But for some reason, incomprehensible in retrospect, the whole thing blew up. At first it might have been interpreted as a spirited discussion about journalism, but gradually the debate began to go off the rails. Although the serious press stayed out of it, all kinds of invective were being spewed out in social media. The offence came not only from financial journalists and industry types, who had reason to set upon their enemy now that he was temporarily weakened, but also from a number of younger writers who took the opportunity to make a name for themselves. They pointed out that Blomqvist was not on Twitter or Facebook, and should rather be seen as a relic of a bygone age, in which people could afford to work their way through whichever strange old volumes happened to take their fancy. And there were those who took the opportunity to join in the fun, and create amusing hashtags like hashtag in Blomqvist's day. It was all a lot of nonsense, and nobody could have cared less than Blomqvist. Or so he persuaded himself. It certainly did not help his cause that he had not had a major story since the Zalachenko affair, and that Millennium really was in a crisis. The circulation was still okay, with 21,000 subscribers, but since advertising revenue was falling dramatically, and there was no longer additional income from their successful books, and since one of the shareholders, Harriet Fanger, was not willing to put up any more capital, the board of directors had, against Blomqvist's wishes, allowed the Norwegian Cerna newspaper empire to buy 30% of the shares. That was not as odd as it seemed, or not at first sight. Cerna published weekly magazines and evening papers, and owned a large online dating site, and two premium TV channels, as well as a football team in Norway's top division, and ought not to have anything to do with a publication like Millennium. But Cerna's representatives, especially the head of publications, Ove Levin, had assured them that the group needed a prestige product, and that everybody in the management team admired Millennium and wanted only for the magazine to go on exactly as before. "We're not here to make money," Levin said. "We want to do something significant." He immediately arranged for the magazine to receive a sizable injection of funds.
That was The Girl in the Spider's Web by David Lagercrantz. Readers, with so many eagerly anticipated titles due out this fall, the easy way to keep current is to keep tuning in and keep checking bookreportradio.com to see which titles are actually worth your time. I hope you've enjoyed today's investigation into our repeat offenders. Let's repeat the exercise in a week. Please join me then for the next edition of The Book Report.